Blog Talk Radio.
So you want your charity to succeed. It's no secret that combining online and offline techniques is the key to modern-day fundraising success, and practical advice is what you need. The Nonprofit Coach with Ted Hart is the perfect place to learn from experts around the world who, along with our host, provide advice you can use. Ted Hart is without a doubt one of the foremost nonprofit thought leaders. Also a successful author, his books cover a broad range of topics from major gift fundraising to use of social media and how to succeed online. Ted lectures around the world, but now he's here for you. From the latest in charity news, technology, fundraising, and social networking, Ted and his guests help you maneuver through this economic downturn in the charitable sector to greater levels of efficiency and fundraising success. Remember, this is a live call-in show. Become part of the show by adding your voice. Call now at 347-324-3080. After the show, you can find all our podcasts at tedhart.com. Just click on radio links. Don't forget to dial 347-324-3080. Now, welcome the host of the Nonprofit Coach, Ted Hart.
And welcome here to the latest edition of the Nonprofit Coach. It's my pleasure to welcome you here to our show. Today is Tuesday, January 17th, and I'm coming to you live from the nation's capital. For those of you who are familiar with the Nonprofit Coach, as you know, you can call in, as the announcer just mentioned, to 347-324-3080. Get an opportunity to ask your question of our Page 2 expert. You can also join us over in the chat room, and for those of you who are super shy, you can email me at tedhart@tedhart.com, and we will ask your question for you when we get to our Page 2 expert. But as always here on the Nonprofit Coach, we start off the show with Page 1 news. You can follow along with the radio links over at tedhart.com. Click on radio and you'll find highlighted all the best radio links for information in the nonprofit sector. Congratulations to Cecilia Menos, who has been nominated by President Obama to head up one of his top White House jobs, Ms. Menos, who replaces Melody Barnes as the director of the Domestic Policy Council, is an immigration expert who has worked for 20 years at the National Council of La Raza, a Latino advocacy group. So congratulations to one of our very own in the nonprofit sector, becoming one of the top domestic policy advisors in the White House. Next up here on Page 1 News is coming to us from the Craigslist Foundation. Bye-bye to the Craigslist Foundation. They are closing up shop. They have recently announced that they will be shutting down their doors permanently in March after years of donating to nonprofit funding efforts. In a statement on their website, the organization's president and CEO said that it will be taking lessons learned from its three main initiatives, the nonprofit boot camp, which most folks are familiar with in the nonprofit sector, highly successful, like-minded and alliance building, and using them to help others. In the quote, it says, after a decade of innovation in support of stronger nonprofits and communities in the Bay Area and nationwide, here on the Nonprofit Coach, we were most involved with the Craigslist Foundation boot camp in New York. They will be winding down operations, celebrated success, and transition its programs to new homes. This decision was made by the board and staff after consultation with Craigslist Inc., whose philanthropy is now focused on supporting numerous worthy charities through its charitable fund. They went on to say that as they wrap this up, the website, which was founded by Craig Newmark in 1995, it will continue to be involved in the nonprofit fundraising efforts. Craig Connects is an offshoot site that works to connect and protect organizations to help organizations who are trying to do good stuff, in the words of Craig Newmark. So goodbye to the Craigslist Foundation. Thank you for all of your support, particularly of smaller nonprofits with very limited budgets. Now, one of the things that we try to do here on the Nonprofit Coach is not only to share the news, but give you insights behind the news. One big topic that comes to us from the Chronicle of Philanthropy is a possible alternative to the .org URL. There is a group of folks who are pushing .ngo, non-governmental organization. As the article says, the use of .org at the end of a website's address has long been accepted as the online shorthand to identify sites that are operated by nonprofit organizations. But now the key organization that manages nonprofit addresses wants charities to adopt the suffix NGO, I'm gathering, because they don't have as much control as they would like over .org. It also wants to implement a process that vets organizations to ensure that if you are using NGO, that you are a legitimate charity. Here with us today is Marnie Webb, who is quoted in this article, and she comes to us from one of our favorite organizations, TechSoup, to help us understand all about .NGO. Hello, welcome today on the Nonprofit Coach, Marnie Webb.
Hi, how are you?
Marnie, thank you so much for joining us again. Of course, we really love and encourage all of our listeners to become fully aware of all the offerings at TechSoup Global, which is a nonprofit organization that provides technology consulting to other charities. But today, you're one of our tech experts to help us understand and sort out .org or .ngo.
Well, I'm not sure that organizations are really going to have to decide between them so much as think about how they will manage a new web address with the .ngo. And I think that there's a lot in preparation for that that organizations and people interested in the sector broadly need to think about in terms of what makes for a legitimate NGO. At TechSoup, one of the big things that we do is help identify organizations all over the world. And we do this to help process product donations from technology companies like Microsoft and Cisco and Symantec. But we also do it to help illuminate the nonprofit sector worldwide. And one of the things that we found out in that process, and as most people probably know sort of intuitively, is that what makes an NGO varies from country to country. There are different standards and different ways of identifying organizations. And, of course, there are many, many good efforts that, for whatever reason, don't ever get whatever the stamp of legitimacy is in that country, the legal stamp. So that makes them no less worthwhile. So I think that in thinking about how a more closely vetted .ngo works, one really has to think about, and we as a sector really have to think about, how will we identify? What rules will we use to say you're a legitimate NGO? We don't want to use necessarily the rules of any one country. We don't want to say, well, we're going to use the standards set forth in the United States. That doesn't seem very fair. And, and then how will you continue to vet them? Most of us, for example, buy our domain names 3 years at a time. We have pretty automatic renewal. But, of course, an NGO can cease to be operating in that time. So how will you do the continuous vetting? Just because somebody was able to sort of pass the whatever the vetting criteria is to receive a .ngo suffix for their domain does not necessarily mean whenever you, a viewer, is looking at it 6 months, 18 months, 25 months later, that they still are an NGO. So
now there's also a lot of money at stake here. Is there not, Marnie? The group that manages .org domain, the Public Interest Registry, they receive about $7.21 each time someone buys a year of rights to a .org domain. So if you have all legitimate charities now needing to buy two domains, a .org and a .ngo, you've just about doubled your registration fees. And with 9 million sites registered at .org, they're getting $65 million in annual revenue for nonprofits. So there's a lot of money at stake here.
Yeah, sure there is. And I think that to think that everybody is going to move a .org to a .ngo is probably wrong. There are probably a lot of individuals and organizations that have a .org suffix that just mean to say I'm not operating this site for profit versus I am a nonprofit. So a lot of them probably wouldn't want to, nor would they be able to make the transition. I think that the
well,
money
but then
is
again,
one...
Marnie, when you're talking about your branding and you're the Red Cross or you're the local soup kitchen and you own the .org and suddenly someone could buy .ngo, you're going to feel a lot of pressure to own that .ngo just
oh,
in
yeah,
case.
Oh, yeah, sure. But I think that's true for most organizations. Large organizations already deal with that with other suffixes. That's not
right.
That's
yeah,
not a
and
new
a lot of folks do own .com and .org and others. So what's
and they,
the,
and they may own some country suffixes as well.
Right. Exactly. Now, so what
and,
do you
and
think
there's
the
a lot that
timing
goes
of this
into
is? This is all in the hands of the Internet Corporation for assigned names and numbers, or ICANN. Where does this roll out, and what do you think is going to happen here?
You know, I don't know what I think is going to happen. I think, to me, the bigger issue than the logistics of the money and moving it around, though that's important, is what makes a legitimate NGO? And how do we make sure that it's fairly vetting these organizations? You know, what makes it different from .org? Because if it's not different, then there's no purpose in doing it, right? I think really thinking about how this, how this is managed from a vetting perspective is sort of the first thing to think about. And then how that rolls out in terms of money and what individual organizations need to do kind of depends on the answer to that question.
Right. And, Marnie, that's a bit unclear. There are two groups that are vying for the opportunity to control the .ngo and public interest registry. So ICANN is in the process of possibly having multiple applications to see who's going to manage this. And it sounds like from your perspective what hangs in the balance is maybe the most important question, and that is what standards will be used.
That's exactly right. And I think that that's not just who chooses it, but I think it's how it's managed and how the sector is engaged in that
right.
over time.
And presumably the winning group would be the one to set that standard, right? I'm guessing ICANN is not going to get
into business. I think if they're doing it well, they're setting the standard with a group of stakeholders that are able to bring a genuinely multinational perspective to the question.
Right, and do we know that that's the case, or we're hoping that's the case?
I don't think we know anything is the case yet because nobody's
right.
been selected for it. So,
right.
I think that we have to advocate for that to be the case. And I think that, you know, whoever owns it, if they want it to truly make a difference, and if you want many of the benefits that would accrue to having a real .ngo suffix that was meaningful, they would pretty much not have much of a choice but to do it.
Right, right, yeah,
because
exactly.
Because otherwise it wouldn't end up being legitimate, and they'd have sort of paid a lot of money and put themselves in a position for something that provided no benefit to them or to the sector as a whole.
Right, right. Well, it seems that, you know, in the article that there's a suggestion that the application cost of $185,000 would be some sort of impediment, but I would doubt that is for an organization that's making $65 million.
Well, I think it depends. I mean, you know, all organizations, what that means varies from organization to organization and where that money goes and how it's managed and what their other programs are. So I would hesitate to say that. I think that it's less an impediment to those organizations that maybe have a recurring revenue in that way, which is probably more important than the fact that the total dollar amount is that they get it in small chunks over time, so it's pretty stable, I think it's, you know, perhaps an impediment for other organizations being in the conversation.
Yeah, exactly. That it may just be down to these two. Marnie Webb,
yeah.
Thank you so much for helping us sort this out. I do think that something of this magnitude is important for nonprofits to be aware of. Certainly, as you said, there's very little that is known, but a whole lot that needs to be advocated. The article in the Chronicle Flansby seems to indicate that this is at least a 9-month process, possibly much longer, due to the fact that there are two competing organizations trying to push for this. But making sure that charities know that they have .ngo on their radar screen, we, of course, here at the Nonprofit Coach will do our best to keep people apprised, and we hope that you'll continue to keep us up to date on anything that you may learn regarding .ngo.
We will.
Thank you, Marnie, from TechSoup Global, one of the top technology experts in the nonprofit sector. Thank you for joining us today on The Nonprofit Coach.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You too. And back here on Page One News, of course, the article on the alternative to .org and say hello to .ngo is available over in the radio links today. Check that out today in the radio links. Next up comes to us is a report that 89% of nonprofits in this new survey are on Facebook. Well, I don't think that that would be quite an accurate quote, because I doubt that of all charities. But certainly those that are in the survey that is being mentioned in the article today, Facebook is not only the most popular commercial social network for nonprofits, but its use is still growing, albeit slowly. On the other hand, although Facebook's growth has slowed since reaching its maximum adoption of nonprofits, the company is still extending its lead over other social networks such as Twitter, LinkedIn, MySpace. So I'm going to take this opportunity to remind all of our listeners that we certainly feel that Facebook is important, but for the average charity serious about raising money, we do rank here on the Nonprofit Coach LinkedIn and Twitter to be more important to both marketing and reaching out to high net worth individuals, foundations, and corporations in the social networking field. So those of you who are serious, we think certainly Facebook is important to getting your word out, drawing a community, and communicating. But when it comes time to seriously reach out to major gift support foundations and corporations, we think that you will find that LinkedIn is far more important. But this nonprofit social network report is posted and available over in the radio links today at tedhart.com. Click on radio links. Now, who will it be? Who will it be signing up? As our listeners know, over on LinkedIn, we do host the People-to-People Fundraising LinkedIn group. This is an opportunity for you to connect with other nonprofit professionals around the world, ask questions, and learn from each other. As of this show, we had 1,498 members. So the question is, who will be the official 1,500th member in the LinkedIn group over at People to People Fundraising? Now, you can go directly to that link at p2pfundraising.org. There's a link to LinkedIn there, or in our newsletter, you can connect there as well. So tell all of your friends if you're already on the group, see who's going to be the 1,500th member of that LinkedIn group. With that, we're going to wrap up page one today and get right on over to page two. And you know what? We're not going to go right to page two because I made a mistake. And the mistake is actually a fortunate one for you, because today we actually welcome a new sponsor to the Nonprofit Coach. And whenever we have a new sponsor, we always want to make sure that we have the opportunity to talk to one of their principals as part of Page One News. So just a little extension here of Page One News for a moment is to welcome Dodd Caldwell here to the Nonprofit Coach. He is with our new sponsor, Bellstrike. We're going to have an advertisement posted later to give you even more information. But I'm always curious and like to take the opportunity to say hello and say thank you to our new sponsor. Welcome here to the Nonprofit Coach, and forgive me for my oversight, Dodd Caldwell.
Thanks, Ted. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so Dodd, again, apologies for rushing off to page two. We've got such a big page two topic today that I allowed my mind to go there. But that does not mean that the significance of your new service is not one that my listeners should be aware of. So tell us briefly, what is Bellstrike and why is it different?
Yeah, absolutely. So Bellstrike is an online service that we developed and launched right around the start of September. It's geared entirely to nonprofits, specifically smaller nonprofits. And really what we let them do is come on and set up an attractive online donation website in about 1 to 2 minutes. So we wire up all the online donation stuff. We have a blog on there. It's really a full-featured website. And we make a lot of the design decisions for them. There is some customization that can be done. But the main goal here is there's a ton of nonprofits out there that are small. You know, they're filing 990Ns that have under $50,000 in revenue. They don't have the money to hire a web designer or web developer, or they don't have the know-how, or they have volunteers that have said they do it and flake out. And this is just a really easy way for them to get online, a non-tech-savvy person, and have a great-looking web presence. So our revenue model is structured such that a smaller nonprofit can really succeed. So we actually don't charge any sign-up fees, and we don't have any monthly charges. What we do is we charge 6% on online donations, and we cap that every month at $80 a month. So a nonprofit, basically, it's kind of win-win pricing. A nonprofit knows that they're never going to pay more than $80 if they do grow, and, you know, or they have 1 month where they have, like, you know, a big fundraising project and raise a ton of money. You know, they aren't paying, a ton for those donations. So that's kind of how we're set up. There's we use WePay, which is kind of a PayPal competitor, that they actually handle all the online donations. So everything goes directly to your WePay account, and you can then have that transferred out to either by check, have a physical check sent to you, or have that deposited into your bank account through an ACH transfer.
Well, I really appreciate the service that you're providing as I travel around the world, and certainly here in the United States. There are so many small nonprofits that, you know, if they have a website, you know, it's probably not very good. Was maybe mm-hmm. developed by somebody's nephew 5 years ago because he was
exactly.
the only one that knew how to build a website. And the updated capacity of websites is so important for nonprofits to be able to market themselves and be able to get their word out. Now, we are going to have more information a little bit later on in the show today, but since it's a big announcement for you, I do want to give you the opportunity to tell my listeners today yourself about the big $5,000 grant contest that you have going on, because that's some nice money in somebody's pocket.
Yeah, absolutely. So we actually just launched this January 1st, and it'll be running through the first quarter. And really, anybody who has a Bellstrike website, we send out auto receipts and things like that. So whenever anybody makes a donation on a Bellstrike website, that donor will arrive at a thank you page. And on the thank you page, it'll, you know, have kind of the normal copy there. Thanks so much for making a donation. Your receipt's been emailed out to you. But we also have a Facebook and a Twitter share button on there. And we also say, hey, would you be willing to vote for us in the $5,000 Bellstrike grant contest? And for every share that a nonprofit gets on Facebook and Twitter during the first quarter, their name is actually entered into the pot to win the $5,000 Bellstrike grant. So a small nonprofit, even if they only have one donation, one share, they still have a chance. Obviously, the more donations and shares you have, the better chance that you have of winning the grant contest. So, you know, it does give an opportunity. It's not like a popularity contest per se, like some of the larger grant contests. But really what it does more than that, and the reason why we designed it this way, is to really encourage donors to share their gifts online, because that – you know, whenever they make that share, we fill it in with a link back to the nonprofit's website. And, you know, just kind of to spread – the goal is just to spread the word. And for a lot of these smaller nonprofits who are really community-based nonprofits, to spread the word about that nonprofit within their communities.
Well, we certainly appreciate your interest in smaller nonprofits and making sure that they have the up-to-date capacity to compete with larger charities. So thank you, Dodd Caldwell, for coming on the show today, and thank you to Bellstrike for becoming our newest sponsor of the Nonprofit Coach. You have a great day.
All right. Thanks so much, Dad. Bye.
Great. Now, officially, we are on to page two, and it is my pleasure, since this is such a very important day. This is the national official public release of the Atlas of Giving 2011 annual giving data report, and what I'm very curious about is the 2012 forecast of giving. Today here on the Nonprofit Coach, it's my pleasure to welcome Rob Mitchell, who has invested 29 years in his career to the nonprofit world as a fundraising practitioner, nonprofit executive, consultant, and now leading two businesses that provide products and services to charities and churches. Mr. Mitchell is currently CEO of Atlas of Giving and Philanthromax. Has proven techniques from American business to create more financial fuel and greater efficiencies for the nonprofit sector. Atlas of Giving is pioneering a major innovation for nonprofits. It measures, analyzes, and forecasts U.S. giving monthly by sector, by source, and by state. In his latest nonprofit staff position, Rob directed fundraising strategy and activities of America's largest health charity, the American Cancer Society. Welcome here to the Nonprofit Coach, Rob Mitchell.
Ted, good to be with you.
Hey, Rob, thank you so much for joining us today. I want to really get right into this and start off by thanking you for being here, but tell us, what is the Atlas of Giving for those of us, those that are listening today who may not be as familiar with the Atlas of Giving?
Sure. Well, the Atlas of Giving is a new technology that allows us, as you said, to measure and forecast charitable giving in the U.S., and we do that each month by sector, so health, education, religion, there are eight sectors that we track, four sources, individuals, foundations, corporations, and bequest, and also by state, and it's all 50 states plus D.C. So this has never been available before. It is a new technology, and I can tell you as a longtime fundraising practitioner and manager that I wished I'd had this when I was a practitioner. It's a real innovation, and it's going to be very exciting to see how today's practitioners use this information to make their organizations more efficient and more effective in their fundraising efforts.
And Rob, this is exciting because one of the things that I think does distinguish professionals from those who are maybe novice in our sector is the need to make decisions and to run our charities on data and to make sure that we are constantly aware of what's happening in the marketplace. Now, I think one of the big questions that folks are going to have, so let's just get it right out there, because we are big fans on this show of the Giving USA report. It is an important report and sort of is an important bellwether for what's happening in the nonprofit sector. But there are some big differences. Doesn't mean that the Giving USA report isn't still an important aspect of data in our sector. However, the Atlas of Giving is dramatically different in that it offers ongoing updates and information, whereas Giving USA does not. So I know there's some other differences, but can you speak to the importance of having ongoing data?
Sure. Well, let me first say that what your listeners may be interested in is how we developed the technology in the first place. And if I could, I'd like to tell you a story that actually germinated back in 2001, the idea for the Atlas of Giving. I had just in June of 2001 been named the first Chief Development Officer of the American Cancer Society. And our fiscal year started September 1, and then September 11th, the world changed for all of us. And at the time, my CEO called me that day and said, "What does this mean for our giving?" And I said, "John, I don't know. I can't imagine that, but it's not good. I'm just not sure how bad it's going to be and how long it's going to last." Well, flash forward a year later, we had outperformed, we thought, our other nonprofits in our sector. And we were trying to give our report to the board, and one of the board members asked the question, "Well, how do you know we've done so well as compared with everyone else?" And I said, "Well, we've checked with this organization and that organization." He said, "Well, that's just anecdotal information. Isn't there a benchmark that you can use that will let us know how we really performed based on the rest of the country and those charities in our sector. And the truth is there wasn't, because there was no timely information or reporting on a monthly basis or even a quarterly basis. All we had at the time was a very good product from Giving USA, but as you well know, it comes out in June of the year following its reporting period. So it's very interesting as a historical document, but in terms of utility, there just wasn't much there. This same board member suggested to me that he felt like I should investigate whether there were economic factors that were directly tied to charitable giving. And at the time, we made a stab at it with my research team at the society, but got nowhere. And so in 2009, when I started Philanthromax, one of the first things we undertook was looking at, could we crack the code? Could we take 42 years worth of annual giving data and link it to specific demographic and economic factors to develop some sort of algorithm, a formula, if you will, for measuring on a more contemporary basis, giving as it occurs, and then hopefully find a way to do a forecast. Well, our hypothesis was that charitable giving is tied to specific economic and demographic factors. So we had a team of 25 PhD level analysts and researchers who looked at this, and they came back. They looked at over 70 different variables, and they came back and said, "We have not seen this great a result before, but compared with 42 years of giving data, we've been able to not only identify that there are specific economic and demographic factors that affect giving. We know what those are, and we've been able to build a formula which will enable you to measure giving as it occurs." And so
that was really the key to sort of your breakthrough on not only being able to look at the data, but also making it relevant for managers, is creating this algorithm that was not just based on survey.
That's exactly right. So in 2009, in 2010, we actually started working with the formula and on an aggregate giving basis for the U.S. The great thing is that the variables that are actually involved in the national giving formula are just a handful, and all those things are available monthly or quarterly. So we're able to look at those, build them into the formula, and measure the trajectory and velocity of giving as it occurs, so on a monthly basis, and report monthly. So we started giving away essentially the Atlas of Giving in 2010, but we weren't completely satisfied because of the good work that had been done before, as you mentioned, by Giving USA, who measures by sector and source. We felt like there were some other things that we could find out, and so we set about to develop the formulas for finding what specific economic and demographic factors affect giving in each sector and in each source. And then to that, we added geography. We added the states. And we had a similar success. By the way, in our national formula, when checked against 42 years of giving data, ours correlates at the rate of 99. Our formula correlates to published giving data for 42 years of 99.5%,
that's the test that comes back to you as to whether or not your data is really reliable.
That's correct. And I'd like to stress this too, because as folks look at all the numbers out there, there are other indexes, there are other estimates, but the difference that the Atlas provides is that we are truly measuring the velocity and the trajectory of giving. So we're looking at the trends. The past is important, only the near distant past. Just as an example, we've just been through the Christmas season. Mattel Toys, I'm sure, has already measured what their sales were for December. I don't think that they're going to spend 6 months analyzing what happened this past December. What they're most interested in is what next December and what next shopping period looks like for Mattel Toys. And similarly, that's what the Atlas of Giving is about. We're about looking ahead. And so we're trying to give practitioners, and by practitioners, I mean folks who are in fundraising, I mean folks who are in the financial and accounting functions in nonprofits and churches, I mean CEOs and COOs or leaders of organizations, and I mean board members, because the data that we're now providing enables us to measure the the performance of specific staff members, specific programs, specific appeals, based on what they should have done and what they did do. So it's a new day, and we have the technology now and the forecast that enables us to build budgets rather than sticking a wet finger in the air at the beginning of the fiscal year and guessing what charitable giving is going to be for the organization. We now have a forecast. And just to go back, flashback to 2001 for a moment, things were rocking along pretty good for most organizations in 2001 before September 11th happened. And then the world changed. The giving world changed. The great thing about our forecast and our updating of it monthly is that when events happen, disasters, both natural and man-made, tax policy changes, a change in government, any sort of major events like that, you're looking at a renewed forecast each month. And so you're able to set a tighter, better budget at the beginning of your year. And then as changes occur, you're able to make adjustments as they happen based on the information that the Atlas of Giving provides.
And that's because you provide data not only on the macro level, but also on the sector level.
Yes. And the state level. And so, you know, as an example, in a large nationwide organization, many of them are broken into geographic divisions, and there's some person who is responsible for fundraising or for income for a certain geographic region. We're providing now the technology for those people to be able to look at the states in their geography and look at a benchmark of how they compare with state benchmarking, and then also look at a forecast for those states. And the outcome this past year on the state level was very different. The outcome on the sector level was very different. So, and by the way, there are different economic factors, Ted, that affect giving for education as opposed to giving for health or the arts. There are different demographic factors that affect demographic and economic factors that affect giving for sources of giving, so individuals, corporations, foundations, and bequest. And so we've identified what those factors are definitively, and we're now able with our formulas, with our algorithms, to measure what giving is and to forecast what giving will be.
And, Rob, we're going to just take a really quick break here, and then we want to come back and talk more about your algorithm and how you've been able to develop this information and this data for charities. We'll be right back.
Remember, our podcasts and archives are always available 24 hours a day at tedhart.com. Click on Radio Links. If you're listening live today, the phone lines are open. Call in and ask a question by dialing 347-324-3080. Now, back to the Nonprofit Coach with Ted Hart.
And as we did on Page One News today, we welcomed Dob Caldwell from Bell Strike. And the question is, how many of nonprofit organizations have run into this situation? You need a great-looking, easily updatable website that accepts online donations. Here's the catch. You don't have the time or the know-how to do it yourself. or you don't feel that you have the money to hire a professional or even to find a volunteer that says that they're able to do it without eventually flaking out or possibly leaving your organization. Well, there's a new service that can help, and it's bellstrike.com. Bellstrike lets nonprofits set up attractive donation-enabled websites in about 1 to 2 minutes. You'll have online fundraising, a blog, auto receipts, entry into their $5,000 grant contest that was mentioned today, and a lot more, all for just going to their website. So if you need a new website, you need a well-designed, specifically for nonprofit organizations website, check out Bellstrike. That's B-E-L-L, like the bell, strike, S-T-R-I-K-E.com. Check out Bellstrike.com. We appreciate all of their support here for the Nonprofit Coach. Now we're going to head right back over to page two. We're here with Rob Mitchell from the Atlas of Giving. Don't forget that you can call in to ask questions at 347-324-3080. You can join us over in the chat room. I see some folks over in the chat room, and you can email us at tedhart@tedhart.com. Now, Rob, I'm jumping a little bit ahead here. We've got Kathleen emailing in who wants, I think she's a little bit eager here. She's wondering, what is the forecast?
So the forecast for 2012 is that charitable giving will grow 3.9% for a total of almost $360 billion.
Now that's a lot of money, and of course, Giving USA has been tracking this 300 billion plus range for giving. So you're saying that fundraising is going to grow in 2012, but at the pace of 3.9%. Now, how does that compare to what happened between 2010 and 2011? That rate of growth.
Well, I think this is probably the bigger story. The bigger story is that 2011 was a resurgent year in giving for in the United States on aggregate. Contributions totaled $346 billion, which was a 7.5% increase over 2010. Now, that obviously is welcome news for many nonprofits, because of the way nonprofits work, the largesse was not shared by everyone, unfortunately.
And you see that at that micro level, as opposed to just sort of macro national data being put out. You're actually able to see what parts of the country, even by state, by region, are actually doing better philanthropically than others?
Yes, and in fact, just one example for you. I mentioned before that giving in different sectors and is there are different economic and demographic factors that affect different sectors. There are also different economic and demographic factors that affect giving that are tied to giving by individuals, corporations, foundations, and bequest, and also by state. Well, here's the thing. There were a lot of good signs in the economy. The stock market had a great ride, especially through July. Then it started to fluctuate, but the Dow still finished up over 8% for the year. We had lackluster growth in the total U.S. economy. I think when the numbers are finally in, it's going to be about 1.5, maybe one at a high of maybe 1.8% for the year. But so charitable giving really outpaced overall giving for the United States last year. But there were some dark signs, too. High unemployment is really affecting giving, and it's affecting giving disproportionately based on how an organization raises money. So organizations that rely on a large number of gifts from a large number of small donors, those donors are more dramatically impacted by continuing high unemployment. And so they have not fared as well in this giving recovery as some other organizations. Donor advised funds had record years this year. Many universities and colleges had record years in giving this year. Those organizations that rely on those small gifts and special event gifts from small donors haven't fared quite as well. And that's troubling. And perhaps more troubling is that what we know at the Atlas of Giving is that unemployment has a lasting impact, and intuitively you can figure this out on your own. When people become reemployed, they have credit card bills that they need to pay. They have pent-up demand for maintenance items and replacement on things like cars and household goods. They haven't maybe taken a vacation in a couple of years. So it usually takes a reemployed person a couple of years before they get back to their former charitable giving habits. And so until the unemployment problem is solved, and even for a while after that, there are going to be some lingering effects of unemployment. The good news is that we're not in recession. The economy is growing, although at a glacial speed, and that's good. The market is looking good. Consumer confidence is good. There are many bright spots in the economic picture, and those things tie well with charitable giving results.
But when you're looking at your data, are we seeing continued stress on, let's say, the annual fund and more bright prospects for major gift fundraising?
Well, if I was in the practitioner mode today, I would really be looking at my fundraising portfolio balance, because one of the things that we've learned from this past year is that a balanced portfolio does very well. Now, if you're heavily weighted in the major gift side or even the bequest side this year or this past year, you did pretty well. You did very well. But as we've seen this past year, things can be going in opposite directions. And so bringing some more balance to a fundraising portfolio, I think, is a smart and prudent thing for any practitioner to consider moving forward. Because if you're reliant specifically on major gifts and campaign kinds of contributions, gifts that people usually give out of assets rather than income, while it worked well in 2011, there could come a time when things don't look so good for that group. And so having a broader base of support, I think, is important. That would be my opinion as a practitioner. I see one of the things we see in the forecast for the year, by the way, is that giving to churches and religion is not going to grow nearly as fast as is not projected to grow nearly as fast as overall giving. In fact, it's less than half. And one of the things in considering this I've thought about is that I think there's some room for churches and religious ministries to look into the good work that's been done in fundraising by secular nonprofits and incorporate some of those techniques into how they raise money.
That sector you think needs to diversify more. What about the secular groups? What's likely to be in the forecast for them?
Well, it's a mixed bag. Education is projected to be the leading sector right now for 2012. Education and the environmental organizations should be up significantly. Our lagging sector is religion. So there's some good sectors. There are, if you look at the sources of gifts, the forecast shows that individual giving should be up over 6%, 6.3%. Foundation grants are currently showing to be the weakest source for 2012 at 2.2%.
And do you find that's because of investments possibly being down and the corpus of some foundation assets have not rebounded, or is that just a conservative approach on the part of foundation trustees?
Well, it all links, Ted, to those factors that drive the giving in those sectors and sources. So One of the things I'm very excited about, I wish I had an answer to every question, but this technology is so new that I think we're going to learn a lot as we go along, and as some academicians in the nonprofit space get to work and do some research on this new data that we now have, because I think we're gonna learn a lot. We're gonna learn a lot about how different events in the economy affect different things. One of the things, very frankly, that we've learned is that although giving is directly tied to economic and demographic factors, there's also the asking factor. And the more you ask, overall, the more you get. And so a lot of organizations really stepped up their solicitation programs in 2011, and it paid off.
So having a professional approach, which, of course, having data like yours to back up, not just a gut approach to fundraising, but actually putting your assets where they're going to do the most good, continues to pay off for charities who have the foresight to do that.
Absolutely. And if you look at, as I look at the national forecast, and by the way, our national forecast isn't just 3.9% for 12 months. We actually have the change per month. And as I look at the current forecast, if you're considering a mailing that you use, a large mailing, just as an example, or a special event to take place in October, if you look at the forecast, I'm thinking that it makes a lot of sense, if you can, to move that solicitation up to September, because September giving is forecast currently to grow at 7.1%, October giving 3.3%. So all things being equal, if you're able to move your mailing or your event up a few weeks, you should do better.
Is that the second most profitable time to raise money at year end, still being the largest? But what other times of the year is it, that September time frame?
You know, it absolutely depends on the economy. And one thing I'll say about year end giving that I've come to believe as a part of working on the Atlas now these last couple of years is that year end giving, in a sense, has become a self fulfilling prophecy. It isn't, though there is some sentiment on the part of donors to give at the end of the year, we all know from all the studies that have been done that tax motivation for giving is far down the list in terms of what motivates people to give. So and such a small percentage of Americans actually itemize deductions and their charitable deductions. So That's not the big thing driving it. What's happened is organizations are doing most of their asking in the last quarter of the year. And that has had an amazing impact. And the fact that the press pumps it up with all sorts of year-end giving stories just perpetuates it. One of the things I'd like to see is an organization taking a look at a forecast and deciding that instead of investing their resources for solicitation at a time when there is the most competition, to perhaps delaying it into the next year and at a time or at a month that is forecast to do quite well, and I think they will. But those sorts of results are going to be fun to watch over time. But I think the year-end giving phenomenon, while there is some donor sentiment to make gifts at the end of the year, people are buying holiday gifts for family and friends, and it has become traditional, no question about that. But most of the asking most organizations are really doing a lot of solicitation at year-end, and that drives a lot of the year-end giving phenomenon.
Now, Rob, looking at 2012, we have major political races in the United States. Some are predicting that the presidential race alone could cost $3 billion this year. What kind of drag does that put on philanthropic giving when people are donating so much to their favorite political candidate?
Well, if you think of the forecast of $360 billion, Ted, for 2012, and then you think about as much as $5 or $6 billion being given for political campaigns, and consider this too, much of that money has already been given in 2011. So it's not all going to be given in 2012. In terms of the large charitable economy, it's not particularly significant. However, if you think about political giving, again, there are certain types of organizations with certain profiles of donors that are going to feel the competition from political fundraising more than are others. One of the things we know from studies that have been done is people who lean more conservatively tend to give more, and by some estimates as much as 30% more. So if an organization's donor profile leans more on the conservative side and more on the individual giving side rather than foundation grants or that sort of thing or major gifts, I think what they're going to feel more of the pain or more of the competition from political fundraising. But in terms of the big picture, political fundraising, while it has an impact on the charitable giving economy, it is not a huge impact. It's less than 1%.
So so that's not one of the bigger factors that you encourage folks to take into consideration putting together their 2012 plans.
No, I'd be much more concerned about timing issues. I'd be concerned about different sectors and how they are forecast to respond. And by the way, you know, the Atlas of Giving has three versions. We have what's called the Atlas of Giving Standard Edition, which is available free at www.atlasofgiving.com with a subscription. So you just give us your email. There's no credit card or anything involved with that, and you can have access every month to the national picture for giving. Now, that does not include sector, source, or state information, but it does include monthly the giving results and forecast. And our second version is what we call Atlas of Giving Professional Edition. There is a small charge for that. You get 12 months access, and you have, well, just as an example, the report that we just posted yesterday is 64 pages of data and an analysis. So we're monitoring giving as it occurs and the events as they unfold that affect charitable giving, and we're reporting on those so you as a practitioner can make some decisions. And then the third version of the Atlas is we have the ability now, using the technology that we've developed, to develop specific benchmarking and forecasting tools for individual nonprofits. So we can look at their giving history and then plug in, we can identify what economic and demographic factors affect giving at those organizations and build them a specific model. And so those are the three things that we have, and so anyone can go to the atlasofgiving.com and register for that free subscription or pay a nominal amount for the Atlas Pro, which is a great deal more information by sector, source, and state.
Now, Rob, I'm watching our time. It's always amazing how fast our show goes when we have such fascinating topics. But before I let you go, I really, first of all, appreciate you using the Nonprofit Coach today to release this very important information, not only the a review of giving for 2011, but also your fascinating forecast and insight into what's going to happen in 2012. Now, you used our format today to release this information, but you also have a webinar coming up, and you want to tell our guests about that.
Yes, we'll be posting information about a webinar that is going to be scheduled for February 1st, and it will be a complete review of 2011 giving results by sector, source, and state, and then a complete look forward into 2012, again, by sector, source, and state on what the forecast shows. And we'll put up the link to the webinar. Ted, we'll send you the link to the webinar so that you could put it on your website, and then we'll have it at theatlasofgiving.com.
So atlasofgiving.com for organization and for information on the webinar. Rob, thank you for joining us today here on the Nonprofit Coach.
It's been great, Ted. It's been a great pleasure, and thank you.
We hope you'll come back. Take care, everybody. We will see you on the next episode of the Nonprofit Coach.
You've been listening to the Nonprofit Coach Radio Show with Ted Hart. Tell all your friends to check out our production schedule and download our iPod and iPad-friendly podcasts at tedhart.com. Thanks for listening to the Nonprofit Coach.